In this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking about beauty and how notions of beauty have changed over time, about how we respond to beautiful things, perhaps about some people have argued how it is you decide something is beautiful or not, and about the place of beauty in life. And our guest for the program is Alexander Niemus. He is a professor of humanities at Princeton University, and he will be talking with us about some of the ideas to be found in his recent book. The title of his book is Only a Promise of Happiness. The subtitle is The Place of Beauty in a World of Art, and it's published by the Princeton University Press. He will be on the campus of the University of Illinois next week, and that will be on Thursday, the 13th, to give a talk on Love and Beauty in Plato's Symposium, Only in the Contemplation of Beauty is Human Life Worth Living. That is the topic. It is sponsored in part by the Department of Philosophy and the Department of the Classics. This is also an event in the MillerCom series, and it takes place on Thursday evening at 7:30 at the Levis Faculty Center on West Illinois in Urbana. All of these programs, they're always open to the public and free, so anyone who is interested in attending can stop by. And, of course, if you're interested in exploring some of the ideas in the book, you can go down to the bookstore and look for the book. It's out just fairly recently. Questions here are welcome, too. We'd certainly encourage people to take part in the conversation. You want to get involved, contribute your thoughts, ask a question. All you need to do is pick up the telephone and call us here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line that is good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. So 333-9455 for Champaign-Urbana, and toll-free 800-222-9455. At any point here, people can call in. The only thing we ask of callers is that people just try to be brief so that we can accommodate as many different callers as possible. But, of course, anybody who is interested can call in. And we're talking with Alexander Niemus this morning from Princeton by ISDN, one of those nice high-quality connections that we like so much because it almost makes it sound like he's right here in the studio with us. We also like to say thanks to Liz Patton at Princeton for her help with the ISDN at the other end of the connection. Professor Niemus, hello.
Good morning, Mr. Inch. Thanks. Delighted to be at your show.
Well, thanks very much for talking with us. I appreciate you giving us some of your time.
Not at all.
I tried very quickly there to sketch out what I thought we would be talking about to put a little bit more flesh on this. Perhaps we could talk just a little bit about perhaps two ideas of beauty or response to beauty, that the first being that of the classical world and Golden Age Greece, I suppose. And the other would be how people, particularly European thinkers and other philosophers, thought about beauty and argued about it once we get maybe into the 19th century. The earlier notion, it seems as if I understand it correct, really did have something to do with the fact that that a beautiful thing, and I suppose that could be a person, it could be a work of art, maybe even could be an idea, should excite us in an almost physical way. And that's the way that you knew that something was beautiful. You knew it by your emotional response.
Absolutely. The idea of passion and desire and love are totally connected with the notion of beauty throughout the classical world, and to a very great extent even through part of the Christian world as well, because, after all, God is the most beautiful thing in the world. Mm. And Christians are supposed to feel this profound, ecstatic love for God. So the two notions, beauty and passion, have always been together, were always together, until, I would say, the beginning, the onset of the modern age, when gradually they started being taken apart by various people in various circumstances and for various reasons as well.
It seems that then the change was that it was almost as if people were arguing that it was absence of passion that was the defining thing, that something could only be beautiful if one could think about it, experience it, contemplate it in an almost unemotional
and emotional, or as the term came to be, the term that came to be introduced in the 18th century, disinterested. There is an interesting reason why this disinterestedness came in. Very broadly speaking, the situation is as follows. Both for the ancients and, of course, for the Christians, beauty was what started us on our way to virtue, goodness, truth, and, in Christianity, of course, God. The creation was beautiful, and in loving the creation, we gradually came to understand and love the beauty of God, which is, of course, identical with his goodness. And for the ancient thinkers as well, beauty was inherently connected with virtue. So it didn't matter. Passion was not a dangerous thing to engage in or to feel when one was attracted by beauty, because eventually, if pursued right, that passion would become something higher, passion for virtue, passion for morality, passion for religion, passion for knowledge. Once the idea of beauty and the idea of goodness were decoupled, which came in an idea that emerged when Christianity started losing some of its hold, though of course it's never lost all of it, some of its hold anyway, on the European imagination, passion became something dangerous, because passion became associated with sexuality and the earthly pleasures.
That's precisely the way that I would imagine that people would think about this earlier notion of beauty as something that should arouse our passions. I guess I would have guessed that the reason that it would have been rejected in the 19th century was that it was just a little too pagan, and that people would worry that somehow the kind of feelings that beautiful objects would inspire would go astray, and that they wouldn't lead to the eventual contemplation of God. They would keep you down here. Yes, they would keep you on the physical plane.
Exactly.
And that was just, and I can imagine people saying, well, you know, that's kind of dangerous.
Exactly.
Really, so for that reason, maybe we'd say better have people contemplating the beauty of nature than the beauty of a person or even a representation of a person.
Exactly. You know? The ancients were quite aware that there is that danger in beauty, but to a very great extent, they thought that it was worth the risk because the payoff, so to speak, was so immense. For us, or at least for modernity, the risk may not have been worth it, and especially when the primary objects of beauty became works of art. To be attracted with passion toward a work of art seems, to put it mildly, inappropriate, right? Because either you're attracted to the representation in the work, the beautiful man or woman, the beautiful decorations or whatever, or you're passionately attached to owning the piece. In both cases, it's something inappropriate. Mm-hmm. By the same token, the passion, the attraction that is passionate, namely the attraction to people, becomes not, of course, inappropriate about people, but it becomes an inappropriate subject for philosophical and moral thinking, because it itself now is so low and earthly and sensuality bound. So as the idea of passion and the idea of beauty are decoupled, so does beauty become much less of a philosophical and ethical problem than it had been in antiquity and even in Christianity. And gradually, of course, that resulted in, generally speaking, the philosophy of art, or aesthetics as we call it, being one of the practiced and respected fields in contemporary and modern philosophy altogether.
Let me just quickly introduce again our guest, Alexander Nemus. He's the author of the book Only a Promise of Happiness, The Place of Beauty in a World of Art, published by the Princeton University Press. He is a professor of humanities at Princeton, is talking with us from there. He will be here on campus next week to take part in a symposium talking on the topic Love and Beauty in Plato's Symposium That's next week, Thursday evening at 7:30, sponsored in part by the Department of Philosophy and Department of the Classics. Questions welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Certainly there are many works of art that have been created over time that seem to be, among other things, frankly erotic. Or at least, for example, on the cover of the book, there is this painting by Manet. I'm sure people know it, Olympia, which represents a woman that I guess we are led to believe is a courtesan, to put it nicely, lolling naked on her divan. And behind her is a woman, a black woman, who no doubt is a servant, holding a big bouquet of flowers that I guess we're to expect that that's from a suitor for her attentions.
A suitor is a generous way of putting it, yeah.
Someone who was interested in purchasing some of her time. Maybe that would be more accurate. And this was a painting that caused an enormous scandal when it was first exhibited, because it was, for a lot of people, frankly, much too erotic. I'm sure people would have said that it was pornographic. And I'm not sure how worked out up people get about the painting today, but to go back to your phrase, I will speak only for myself, it is difficult for me to look at it with disinterest.
Absolutely. Yes.
but at the same time, you know, one wonders, well, now really, is that the appropriate response to somehow, by looking at it with some level of interest, does that put us in a bad light? Does that put in the painting in the bad light? Does it put Manet in a bad light? How exactly are we to sort all these things out?
Those are important questions. The philosophical and the art critical tradition from the 18th century to today, or close to today, with, of course, many exceptions, but nevertheless, the overall line would be that precisely it is wrong in every way. It's wrong of us, it's wrong of the painting, and it's wrong of Manet to engage in producing an art object which either aims, or whether it aims to or not, incites, so to speak, the lower passions. Immanuel Kant, the great German philosopher who really started, the most important influence in the field of aesthetics in general, insisted that whenever we have an interest, as he put it, an interest in an object, we do not have an aesthetic attitude about it. The aesthetic attitude, or the aesthetic judgment, or beauty, is always, he said, disinterested. We are not supposed to want to own the thing. We are not supposed to want to take any advantage of it or from it. We are not supposed to want it. All we want to do is to contemplate it. And interestingly enough, when Manet's Olympia was first exhibited in Paris in the mid-1860s, and as you said so correctly, it causes immense scandal, its first great defender was none other than the author Émile Zola, who wrote a long essay arguing that people who were looking at this painting and actually seeing a courtesan and sexuality depicted in it were completely wrong, because the only thing that mattered about that painting was color and line. The woman, the bed, the cat, the black servant are all, he said, occasions for Manet to use color. And anyone who looked at it as a subject was completely misguided. So you can see how desperate one can get in order to defend this disinterested aspect of art appreciation from the encroachment of human passion.
It seems that this, for some people, this distinction between interest and disinterest has also been a convenient way to distinguish between high culture and low culture, and
Absolutely.
People who are cultured and people who have no culture, in the opinion of some. And they would almost make this argument that that's the way that you tell the difference between people of quality and everybody else, is what they consider to be beautiful and how they respond to it.
The idea being that in popular culture and popular art or mass art or whatever you want exactly to call it, the reaction is direct. The audience does not really appreciate the how of the work, but only the what. Whereas in high art, in the fine arts, what we are supposed to appreciate is the technique, the craftsmanship, the beauty of the method by which something is depicted, rather than the something itself. Now, I have real, real doubts about this whole distinction between high and low. Mm-hmm. And I think that a little look in history can introduce some pretty interesting and perhaps disturbing ideas. Now, one of the most famous episodes in the history of art and the philosophy of art is the final book of Plato's Republic. The Republic, of course, which was written in the 4th century BC, was Plato's plan, his master plan, his blueprint for an ideal state. And the amazing thing is that the end of this very long book, in the 10th of its parts, Plato engages in a scathing attack on epic and dramatic poetry, on Homer and the great Greek Athenian dramatists, Aeschylus, Sophocles, Euripides. He wants no such art in his ideal city. So the first, and the Republic is the first work that actually discusses the arts, the first work that discusses the arts ends by denouncing them. And we want to say, we say to ourselves, how could Plato, who himself was an exquisite writer, an absolutely magnificent artist, how could he not appreciate the greatness of Homer and the greatness of Aeschylus? It's an immense problem, and people have thought very, very hard about it. Well, if actually you look into Greek tragedy, the way that Greek tragedy was produced in the 4th and the 5th century BC, what you realize is that it's nothing like our going to the theater today. I mean, we dress up to go to the theater. We are told to turn off our telephones and to eat our little lozenges beforehand so that we won't make any noise. We're not allowed to cough and so on and so forth. It's almost a religious atmosphere. Mm-hmm. When the ancient Athenians went to the theater, which was always produced as a competition so that people had favorites and non-favorites, they went there for a whole day because they would see four plays in one day. They would be packed in this theater along with their food and everything else. They would scream. They would shout. They would pelt actors they didn't like with tomatoes and eggs. Right? And it was basically much closer to what today would be a football game than a high cultural activity. What Plato was denouncing, in other words, was not art as we know it today. He was denouncing the popular art, the popular culture of his time. And the reasons that he gave for denouncing, and that's what's amazing, are the same reasons that most people today, for example, would use for attacking television. Poetry, Plato said, first of all, confuses the authentic and the fake. It makes it difficult to tell what is real and what isn't. Second, he said, it is essentially useful and sort of intended for representing violent and sexual subjects. That's the real subject, the appropriate subject for drama and epic. And third, it can turn, as he puts it, even the best among us, it can make even the best among us, the great people, the educated, the good, the virtuous people, act in ways that would be ashamed to act otherwise. Now take those three things and apply them to television, and you'll see that it is exactly the same argument that is still being made today. The amazing thing is that the low culture of the ancient Greeks has become the paragon of high culture today. And that's where the distinction between high and low is a very problematic one.
Well, then it sounds as if you would, and you can correct me if I have this wrong, you would make the argument that rather than making this distinction, this perhaps artificial distinction between high art and low art, or good and bad, or popular versus something else,
elite,
that it would make more sense to talk about art that either is effective in the sense that it touches us or not. And maybe you say, well, good art perhaps is any art that moves us, and that bad art or less than effective art is something that doesn't.
No, I think you're absolutely right. With the one little qualification, I think there are different ways in which different arts can move us. So I don't want to say that Greek tragedy does not move us today. Of course it does, and very, very deeply. But so does, I think, not all, but some of the art we see on television, some of the art that we see in cinema, some of the art that we have in photography, some of the art that we see in novels, all those things are, of course, denounced as the worst thing that could ever happen to the human mind when they were first, when they first appeared, especially the novel. It was really looked down upon by the intellectuals of the time. The great English poet and essayist Coleridge said that wherever the reading of novels prevails, the human mind is destroyed. He said, I wouldn't even call them pastime. He says, I would call them kill time. So there are different ways in which we are moved by different forms of art. So I would certainly agree with you, however, given that qualification, that art that is great or that is good or that is successful is art that affects us. Art that doesn't. What does that mean? That means that the contrary of beauty, the contrary of aesthetic greatness, is not ugliness. It's nondescriptness. It's remaining indifferent to something that is the greatest failure for an artist. It's making something to which people are indifferent, that they just pass by without a second look. Something that is ugly still attracts you. And even if you're disgusted by it, it still has made an impression on you. And if it's in your mind, someday you might find something that you actually do like.
Yeah. Well, that I'm sure that gets that touches on the notion that that many artists would advance, I would imagine, certainly contemporary artists would advance, that art should not necessarily be pleasing, that it could be important for it to be provocative. If your first reaction is to be pushed away, that's not necessarily bad. Now, that makes it difficult to make the argument that it is in some sense beautiful if your first sort of reaction to it is that it's ugly. But I think that this goes to the notion that art should have a purpose beyond being decorative.
Absolutely. And you see, we always tend to connect pleasure and beauty, and I don't think that's actually right. I mean, some beauty gives pleasure, of course, but pleasure and beauty are not essentially connected. Very often, seeing a beautiful thing can cause, first of all, the feelings are much more complicated than that, even if you want to call them pleasure. They are a very complex and multifaceted pleasure. But there are many things. We are afraid of beauty. We are often ashamed in the presence of beauty because of our own inadequacies. We want to get to know beauty. We are curious in the presence of beauty. It's not just pleasure. And very often we feel directly that beauty is very dangerous. I mean, think how many times one is attracted by, say, a human being and finds a human being absolutely beautiful, but is profoundly and intensely frightened of any kind of connection that may be established between that person and oneself. It's not always pleasure. Sometimes, in fact, we hate beauty for being beautiful. Either because we can't have it, or because we know that if we do get to have it, it will be a terribly bad thing for us in other ways. So beauty and pleasure don't go together. And what's important about art, I think, is first of all to get you to look at it, to remember it, to be impressed by it, to be, as you put it, affected by it. The rest will come afterward. But if you pass it by, if you can't continue reading the poem or the novel, if you can't listen to the piece of music, if you can't look at the painting, it's gone. It's gone. It's not there anymore. It doesn't exist for you.
We're at a midpoint here, and I would like again to introduce our guest, Alexander Nemus. He is a professor of humanities at Princeton University. Some of the ideas that we're talking about here this morning can be found in his most recent book. You might like to look at it. The title is Only a Promise of Happiness, The Place of Beauty in a World of Art. It's published by the Princeton University Press. He'll be talking next week here on the U of I campus about love and beauty in Plato's Symposium. It's talk in the Millercom series that's hosted by the Departments of Philosophy and Classics. Next Thursday evening, 7:30 at the Levis Faculty Center. And if you're interested, you should stop by. All these programs, they're always free and open to anyone who would like to attend. And questions are welcome here, 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. I think that probably that there would be some people who might actually say that they weren't sure that beauty had much place at all in their life, high, low, or otherwise. Why Why is it important, or do you think that it is important for people to be involved in beautiful things, whether they're actually in their life or whether they're things that maybe they just go someplace and they visit them?
I wouldn't believe anyone who said that beauty had no place in their life. Perhaps the beauty of high art has no place in their life, or the beauty of people has no place in their life. Mm-hmm. But I don't think that a human life is possible without some interaction with beauty, if only to the extent that one chooses what objects one will surround oneself with in one's domicile, in one's house. Now, unfortunately, many, many people in the world, most of the people in the world probably, have so little opportunity to engage in activities other than trying to survive, that there is indeed very little time and very little leisure to engage in a kind of active relationship with beauty. But even there, people have their songs, they have their dances, they have their stories, they have their sacred objects. All those things are part of what I would call a world of art or a world of beauty. Now, why is beauty important? That's a very important question in its own right, and it's a very difficult one, too. I'll tell you why I think so. I think that when a beautiful thing strikes you, if, as I believe, you also desire it in some way or another, what that means is that you feel that the beautiful object, whether it's a person or a work of art or even a natural object, it has something to offer you that you have not yet seen. You have a feeling that there's something more to it that is valuable for you to get, even though you're not quite sure at the time what it is. And if that's the case, to find something beautiful, to be struck by something beautiful, by a beautiful thing, is to have a sense that in one way or another, although you're not sure what that way is, your life will be at least a little bit better if that object, that person, were part of it. And conversely, if you were part of its life. So to think that something is beautiful is not, as we often think, the end of our interaction with an object. It's not as if we try to understand what it is and then we say, therefore it's beautiful, now I know about it, let me go to the next one. To think that it's beautiful is to be in the middle of interacting with it, in the middle of the process of interaction, to say, there's more here that I want to come to learn, to understand, and to appreciate. And that's what I mean when I say that beauty is only a promise of happiness, right? Mm-hmm. It promises you that there's something more to it than you've seen already. But you don't know what that something is. Hmm. And you don't know what it will do for you once you acquire it, if you do. And that's the danger, because it can promise you things that it doesn't deliver. Or worse, think of that, worse, it can deliver those things and they turn out to be really bad for you. But by the time that it delivers them, you have become so accustomed to them that you no longer see them as bad. So that you think you are happy or you are better off, when in fact you've been degraded and perhaps corrupted by the object or the person in general. And that's why, as I said before, again, beauty is a very, very dangerous thing. It attracts us. We don't know to what. It can either fail in its promise, or it can succeed, it can fulfill the promise, and still hurt us immensely. Hmm.
I'm sure that we can find, going back a long time in human history, examples of objects that had function but were more than purely functional, that would tell us that those people were interested in making things not only that were useful tools, useful devices, they also wanted them to be pretty. They liked the idea that things had beautiful form, that they were beautifully decorated, that they were very pleasing, and that somehow that was an end in itself beyond the fact that it could actually have some purpose. Do you think that that is something that is somehow a fundamental characteristic of human beings, or became one at some point?
I think it did become one, probably is a fundamental characteristic, and I think it became one at least at the latest, if not early, at the latest, by the first time we can have a recognizable culture. There is no culture without some kind of, call it decoration, call it beautification, call it art. There's no culture that doesn't have objects that, as you put it so well, perform more than their work. Now, what is it when you have an object that performs more than its work? Suppose that you're making a whole bunch of combs, right? I mean, combs have always been part of very ancient cultures. And yet we see that each of those combs is a little different from the other. Each has an ornament that the others don't. What are you trying to do when you do something like that? You're trying to make the object that you produced stand out among others of its kind. Right? It's a little different from the others. It has its own character, its own style, its own personality. And ultimately, I think, the value of beauty, to return to your earlier question, the value of beauty lies in the fact that beautiful objects show us ways in which one thing can differ interestingly, importantly, and valuably for another. And in that sense, they inspire us with the same desire. For ourselves, they inspire us to be different, to differ from the others, to establish our own voice, our own style, our own personality. And that, I think, is a crucial aspect of what it is to live a human life, and one, unfortunately, which, by and large, modern philosophy has not paid enough attention to. I think most of the values that philosophy has paid attention to are what one might call moral values, the values of what we owe to each other, the values that enjoin us to treat each other equally, to treat everybody as a human being, to be fair to everyone, not to prefer one person over another for bad reasons. The values of beauty, the values of aesthetics, if you want, are the values of our difference, the values that, against the background of our similarities, also distinguish us from one another. And that is something very, very important and worth thinking about. We admire people both for their morality, but also for their originality. And those two are absolutely essential to human life.
I think it's an interesting notion that perhaps the beginnings of culture or the birth of culture is rooted in the desire for an individual to distinguish himself or herself from the others. That it may be that it starts at this point where we start to look around our fellows and have this feeling that we're not just one of this big group and that we're all sort of the same, that in fact, we're different. And perhaps what we want to do is do something deliberate to emphasize that difference.
Exactly. And also, don't forget that the moment that a culture is established, it distinguishes itself from other cultures. There can be no we unless there are others. So the idea of being distinguished, of standing out, is already established in the very notion of what a culture is. And now within that group, which as a whole is different from the other group, there are smaller groups, say, for example, villages or families or even individuals, which themselves want to establish their own independence, even though, of course, it's always, as I said, against the background of a larger whole to which they belong. But All the way down to the smallest individual unit, the desire to put your own stamp upon your life and the world, I think, is unquenchable.
I don't want to get too wild here, but
yes.
does this also have something to do with consciousness, the development of consciousness, or the sense that I am an individual? And have that sort of reflexive sense, and that I understand that there is this way in which I am an individual, and am indeed independent, connected to, but independent of these other individuals that I just happen to be hanging out with.
I think that's a very interesting point. I hadn't thought of it that way, but consciousness always involves a point of view, and there's an obvious sense in which my point of view is necessarily different from yours. So we don't have a choice about that. Now the question is it going to be interestingly different? In other words, is it going to be different in a way that will make another person notice it and remark on it and be attracted to it? So the question for me is not so much, shall I be different or shall I not? It's only, how will I be different? And that's where the great artists and the great personalities and the great individuals of human history are better than the rest of us, for better or worse.
I'm interested in perhaps returning a little bit to the idea, or to talk about the way that we are taught to experience art, particularly high art, that we're supposed to meet it with a quiet reverence, and that the idea is that if you're going to the symphony, or if you're going to a museum or something like that, that it's a little like going to church.
That's a secular religion, absolutely.
Indeed. How is there a way, though, to, I don't know, how does one to break that down then, and to, in a sense, also to open up that possibility for anyone who might think that that's not for me, that's for somebody else, that's not, I'm not allowed, you know, I don't meet the minimum qualifications for walking in the door.
Right. I think you're raising a question that is very, very dear to my heart. That's a cliche. I mean, it's something I really think about a lot. For example, think about going to a museum. The museums are built to look like temples, or churches, or banks, or something like that. Really, places of high seriousness. You go into a museum, you see all these paintings hanging on the walls against those usually white walls. You see them, most people see them, without very much background. And they don't know what they're supposed to do with them. Not only do they lack certain accounts of certain aspects of knowledge, they lack certain knowledge that has unfortunately become necessary for us to appreciate the art of the past, but nobody ever tells them what they're supposed to like, what they're supposed to dislike, what they're supposed to look at. So you go to the museum, and here's one great Rembrandt, and you've seen it, and there's one great Titian, and you see that, and there's one great Manet, and one great Picasso. And you see them and say, okay, so what's great about them? You don't know, because you have no idea how difficult it is to make a good painting. Okay, suppose that museums, instead of just having great paintings, put some second, third, fourth, 15th, 20th rate paintings next to them and said, look, forget about knowing mythology and knowing the social conditions of the 15th century. Look at a Virgin Mary done by Giotto. And look at a Virgin Mary done by somebody who clearly has much less talent and has succeeded in doing something much less important than Giotto. See the differences between them. And that's how you begin to get on the way to appreciation. Appreciation necessarily requires comparisons. And one thing that our museums don't do is to allow us to make comparisons. Put a great Rembrandt's portrait on the wall and put next to it a really bad self-portrait by anyone. It doesn't matter who it is. It doesn't matter whether it's contemporary or of Rembrandt or contemporary of ours. Just put a casual bad portrait next to it and then try to show people, this is what it is to make a great painting.
And you think that the differences would be so obvious that at least to start out, you wouldn't need to have had taken a course in art appreciation to see that there is something about one that really sets it apart from the other.
Well, I think you always need to be discussing it. Mm-hmm. You always need somebody there who will be able to point to things. I don't think people will just see it all by themselves. But that's what a museum should be doing. And furthermore, they should also put rugs down on the floor so that our feet don't hurt when we walk through them. No, seriously, I mean, it's a very obvious point, and I know why they don't do it. It's expensive. The rugs get worn out, and they have to be replaced, whereas a hard floor is much better. But in fact, it's uncomfortable to go to a museum. It's highly uncomfortable. I mean, if you see the people in the museum, they're always trying to hide the fact that they don't understand what's going on. They have these blank faces, and they're standing uncomfortably because working on those hard floors for hours is really unpleasant. And children hate it, and so did I when my parents made me go to museums. Yeah. And now I go to museums for a very short time. I go for the shortest possible time, so I don't get exhausted.
And I think that I think what you say is absolutely right. And perhaps it's because we don't get the opportunity to go very often, or as often as we might like. So we treat it as if it was a marathon,
exactly,
as if we're supposed to see everything. And so that means that you spend 30 seconds in front of each work, and after a while,
They just melt into each other. You no longer notice anything. Of course, I mean, think of how all those poor children, and I put myself among them when I was a child, who are dragged. You're in Venice for the first and perhaps the last time. You have to see every single painting. And, you hate it, absolutely hate it. Or you go to a concert, and the concert lasts, a classical music concert, lasts 2.5 hours. But your attention span is no longer than 15 or 20 minutes. What do? You just sit there and cringe and move in your chair and try to count the minutes until the time goes over. Well, you're not going to like anything. But put a nice short piece of classical music and put a less nice short piece next to it and show to people what the difference is. I think they'll enjoy themselves much, much more without becoming scholars.
We have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. We're talking with Alexander Niemus. He's professor of humanities at Princeton. Some of the ideas here you will find in his most recent book, Only a Promise of Happiness, The Place of Beauty in a World of Art, published by the Princeton University Press. And as I've mentioned a couple of times, he'll be here on the campus of the University of Illinois visiting to give a talk next week. This is Thursday night, talking on love and beauty in Plato's Symposium. This is a presentation that keynotes a conference, Life, the Universe, Everything, and More, Plato's Timaeus Today. Held over 13th through the 16th, hosted by Department of Philosophy and also of the Classics. And here, questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. I'm still here with the notion of how it is that we somehow get people more involved with art, break down those distinctions between high and low, and also tell people that, it's okay to be excited about art, that's really
the right way to be about it, that is indeed
the right way to be about it, and that's part of how it is you try to make some distinction between, is this good or not. It does have a lot to do with how it makes you feel.
Absolutely. That, again, is something that we have overlooked, because the notion of disinterestedness also seems to imply to people that the feelings that a work of art produces in you, or even a person produces in you, are really irrelevant to their character. And I think that's absolutely wrong. I think, to go back to Manet's Olympia, which we were talking about earlier, I think that if you look at this painting and you feel absolutely no trace of attraction towards this, I think, fantastically beautiful woman, you're not seeing the painting for what it is, because I think part of the purpose of that painting is precisely to make you attracted to this woman. The point that it's trying to make is extremely complex. It's not just that, here, I made this picture so that you can get your jolly, so to speak. Mm-hmm. Manet is making something much more complex. He's saying, hey, why are you attracted to her? Who are you? What position do you occupy when you're attracted by this person who, as you put it, is a courtesan with the bouquet of flowers which an admirer, as you put it again, mm-hmm. has sent? Where are you standing when you look at that picture? You're standing at the place where the admirer would be standing if you were there. So who are you? Relative to that picture, who are you relative to that woman? Who are you relative to that painting? You're a consumer. Now, is that a good place to be? Those are the questions that the painting raises. They're very complex, high, so to speak, culture questions, but they are introduced by the lowest of the low passions. And what we need to show to people, I think, is that those lowest of low passions, especially the passions that are inspired by popular art, are not different in kind from the passions that are inspired by high art, that they already know how to look and appreciate art.
Was that sort of feeling of arousal and perhaps mild discomfort about that and not being quite sure? Do you think that's indeed what Manet intended?
Oh, absolutely. I think it was the painting was a complete slap in the face of middle class France. Because most of the erotic paintings that were circulating, and there were quite a few of them, and very, very explicit, were either with mythological subjects, or they had to do with the Orient, Orientalist paintings, so-called, that they took all the sexy bodies and put them in harems in the Ottoman Empire, or in Syria, or whatever. What Manet shows in that painting is that the sort of the sexuality that these other painters, this contemporaries, displaced onto this imaginary Orient, on this imaginary past, was right in the middle of Paris, right then and there. And by putting the viewer in the position of this woman's client, he said, you are no different from all those people on whom you look down, and you are in fact no different from this very woman whom you look down upon.
And that's what you can, I'd say that all you have to do is look at her, and not look at her body, but look at her face.
She knows.
And she knows, exactly. And that's exactly what she's saying. That's what she's, you know, she's saying
good.
To you,
yes.
I know what you want.
That's right. And I'll give it to you, you know, if the flowers are good enough, I'll give it to you. No, it's an extraordinary painting. But you see, you don't get it if you just look at it as color and line. Mm-hmm. You don't get that. And it seems to me that most of the great works of art, most of the great paintings that we know, have an aspect like that that we need to bring into account. And ultimately, what we need to do is to understand that even the beauty of persons is something that is worth thinking seriously about. And that beauty is not, in another sense now, what the ancients thought it was, namely an objective feature of things that depends, say, on the golden mean, on symmetry, on proportion, on unity. It's something much more complex than that, and to a very great extent, it depends on the perceiver.
It's all about it. It's all about what it is as it's filtered through your experience.
Think about it. I think it's impossible to find a person one loves not to be beautiful. You can't say of someone, she or he is ugly, but I love him or her. Now, if that's true, consider, most of us are not beautiful by those objective standards. We are not symmetrical, we don't represent the golden mean, we are not thin enough, we are not this, that, or the other. Yet, most people in the world, I should think, have either loved or been loved. And ideally, not often, but not always, certainly, not by the same person. So what is it about all these people? They're ugly, but they love one another. I mean, we are ugly, let me put it that way, and we love one another. And in loving one another, we are not finding each other ugly. We're finding each other beautiful. Is it just a deception? Or is it that beauty is something that is not just the object of love, but also the product of love?
We have a caller here to get in before we make sure that we do that before we run out of time. Someone who is standing by here on a cell phone, so we'd better get right there.
Okay.
Line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I'm not going to say this very articulately, so I hope you can understand enough to to answer my question. Since art is effective when we respond to it and on an emotional level, what are we to do when our response to the artist overpowers the ability to respond to the art? In other words, does it matter that this composer of operas was, you know, religiously intolerant, or does it matter that this painter was a wife beater?
No, I see exactly what you mean. No, I think that's a really good question. No, absolutely. I mean, here, Wagner, right, is a classic example of that.
Yes, that's what I was trying not to say out loud.
That's all right. I think you should.
Controversy.
No, but look, I think you're raising a very deep question. And you see, people try to make everything cohere and fit with everything else. I think that those people, and I include myself among them, who like Wagner, who love Wagner and admire him as a musician, and who also think of him as a rabid nationalist and anti-Semite, not just an anti-Semite in his private life, but in his music. I mean, he has characters who sing Judaic or Hebrew tunes, right? And they're bad guys. We have to live with that problem. It's a problem. What do you do? It's not an easy resolution. And it's true that many works of art are highly immoral. Suppose that you're a rabid atheist. Are you going to like Raphael? You know, if you think that, you know, Christianity is a terrible idea? Or if you're a Christian, are you going to hate, say, Phidias, the great sculptors of antiquity, because they are depicting idols and not real gods? These are problems we can't avoid.
Hmm. So that's you.
I think we lost.
She posed her question and hung up.
Okay,
maybe it was better for her to listen
to
on
hear,
the
yeah,
radio
sure.
than to try to listen
a good
on
answer.
The phone. There is no real answer other than yes, that's the problem, and that's something that you're going to have to wrestle with. And
that's right.
I can't tell you how exactly to work that out.
No, I don't think we can. Now, I don't think that if in one's private life, if an artist in his private life is, say, an anti-Semite or whatever, that should have very much an effect on one's appreciation of one's work. So it could. I think the real problem comes when the anti-Semitism or whatever the immoral feature that we disapprove of is enters the works themselves. And that's where we have, I think, a very serious problem. Great art is not always moral. And that's one big difference between beauty and virtue. Virtue always tends towards the good. Beauty does not. And that's its danger. Is the danger great enough that we should do away with beauty? First of all, it isn't. And secondly, even if it were, we couldn't do it.
Mm-hmm. We are coming to the point where we're going to have to finish because we've used our time. I want to say again, first of all, that if you're interested in reading some more on some of these ideas, you can look for the book which we have talked about, Only a Promise of Happiness, The Place of Beauty in a World of Art, by our guest, Alexander Niemus. It's published by the Princeton University Press. He'll also be here on the campus next week on and we'll be giving a talk, this one open to the public, anyone who's interested, Thursday, 7:30 at the Levis Center, Love and Beauty in Plato Symposium. Will you be dealing with some of the same sorts of questions?
Yes, very much. I mean, I'll try to find the ancient notion of passionate beauty in Plato and to try to connect it, of course, with the love of knowledge, which is essentially involved with it, because when we love something, we want to come to know it. Hmm. So, yes.
Very good. And again, people who are interested, it is open to anyone. It's hosted by the Departments of Philosophy and the Classics here on the U of I campus. Well, Professor Niemus, thank you very much for talking with us.
Oh, thank you very much, Mr. Lynch. That was extremely interesting for me. I hope it was for you and your audience as well.
It was indeed. And we also want to say thanks to Liz Patton there at Princeton for her help in setting up this ISDN connection so we can have such a good-sounding connection with our guest.